I'm getting a raffle for the next time all set up here. I'm Bill, I'm alcoholic. I was actually quite honored that I got asked to do this. I was going to say it was about time. And then try to think back who's all the AA speakers that were here before me. And I'm not going to do that. I'm not a, my sobriety date's April 1st, 1989. I'm not a AA fundamentalist, so I'm not going to rattle off my sponsor's name, his sponsor's name, and all the people I sponsor and all that stuff. Mostly because we didn't do that when I got sober, and so I don't feel the need to do it now. I do have somebody I work with, and I do have some people that I bounce my difficulties off with. Happened at the retreat. I was having a difficult time trying to make a decision about to do this relationship I had going on, and what better place to have a question than in a room full of young men, who most of whom I actually do respect their opinions. I went in and talked about five of them. What would you do in this situation? And I got a group conscious about what to do in that situation, which was very valuable to me. So that's kind of how I work in AA right now. I'm not a maintenance drinker. I'm a binge drinker. I've been sitting around here for 36 years, and I hear people every now and say, "Well, I drink a quart a day." And my response to that is, "Well, how did you stop at a quart?" Because I never could. Once I start to drink, I always am stopped by something. It's never my conscious decision to stop. So I either pass out, which is the best way to stop. The worst way to stop is have the cops intervene on you. I've come to in places that I had no idea how I got there. In states of dress and in states of loss of bodily functions. Were just disgusting. I have a yet that I like to say, and that is I've yet to crap my pants while handcuffed in the back of a cop car. I'm not a drinking a martini, getting a DUI on the way back from the bar kind of drunk. I am a sloppy, violent, angry mess of a man. I'm something that you have to deal with when I get drunk, and I don't have any illusions that it will get better if I decide to take a drink today. That's going to go right back to that, and I keep hearing this idea, and Jelly Jean used to say it: this thing progresses even if we don't drink. And so I'd hate to find out where it would have progressed to at this point. So. That's where I'm at with that. I do like to mention that even though my sobriety date's April 1st of 1989, I didn't really start coming to AA on my own initiative until about August of 1989. I was intervened upon against my will by the United States Navy. They had decided, of all the people who were drinkers in the United States Navy, and there's, the United States Navy brags about being the world's biggest drinking club. And they picked me out of the crowd and said, "That guy is a problem." And I will be honest with you, at the time, I did not agree with them. I thought that there are many more problems than me. And I could actually sit there and give you a detailed list of all the guys that were worse drunks than me. They picked me out of the crowd and they said, you're the guy that we need to pay attention to. Subsequently, looking back, I think they made a really good decision. When I was down in it, I really didn't see it. But having been separated from it for even probably through 6 months, I could actually go back and look at it and say, yeah, I did need to get it when they decided it was time. in that, I want to recognize, and if I ever meet these guys again, I will give them a big hug, which they'll probably not like, because they're not us. These were all just regular guys, and they were just doing their jobs to the best of their ability, and they did not come off of it. The first one is my leading petty officer in the ship I was on. He actually called the drug and alcohol program advisor on the ship, said he was me, and made me an appointment. And so I got down to the drug and alcohol prevention guy's office, and he said, well, what did you want to talk about? I said, I don't really want to talk at all. Anyway, that's kind of how it. And then his boss, the CO on that ship, he did his job. It was supposed to be done. And I went to the hospital, and I actually transferred straight out of the hospital, which you're not supposed to do, but I did. I came from that ship in Long Beach up here to Mare Island to go to school. And then there was another asshole up here who, hey, I walked into his office, and he said, hey, I've been waiting for you. And because he had my folder right there on his desk. And he said, well, I've been reading your history. And he started sending me to AA meetings. And he, just to be, you know, good, and sure, he actually sent me to a couple NA meetings too, you know. And he had told him, set me an appointment every week on a Thursday at 3 o'clock. I had to come over and talk to him. And he asked me what I've been doing. He asked me, do you have a sponsor? What meetings did you go to? So on and so forth. And after like a week, I kind of caught on to the idea that he's going to want to answer these questions, you know. And so I had to answer them. And so what happened was I started coming to AA meetings. We had a meeting right there on the base at this building, still there, at noon. So I went to that one every day, and I was almost always at a meeting out here in town. I ended up at the Vallejo Fellowship on April 3rd, which is 2 days after my sobriety date. And I started coming to meetings over here in Benicia not too long after that. And I got in with the fellowship here. So that's kind of how it was. The reason why I bring that all up is that I don't want to skip over the fact that these guys were very important in my life. And so much so that I would actually sit them down, if I ever came across them, and I would actually try to explain to them exactly what them just doing their jobs impacted my life. And so I'd like to bring that up. I'm a firm believer. I am absolutely a firm believer in this. If there was a political spectrum in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd probably be slightly left of center. What I've noticed in AA over the last 10 or 15 years is we have a lot of people starting to thump the big book, and they're, you know, you have to go to the big book, and you have to have this 12 and 12, and you have to do all this, and you have to do all that. Which I'm not going to say is bad advice, because it is good advice. But when Bill Wilson met with Dr. Bob in 1935, there wasn't any coffee maker commitments to give to Bob, and there wasn't a big book to read to for Bill to read to for Bob. There wasn't any meetings. There weren't any steps. We didn't have traditions. We didn't have anything. We just had Bill, who was gifted with the gift of desperation, as we've been told it is. And the coolest part of the story for me is Dr. Bob, because I identify with the most. Dr. Bob had been drunk the day before and pissed Ann, his wife, off. And so he knew to enable to make Ann happy, he had to go to this meeting with this guy. And so they walked in, and he said, I'll give this guy 15 minutes. You know, and he had to do it because he had to get in off his case. He had to get, you know, and I know we've all been there. We've all had somebody who wanted to talk to us about our drinking, and that's where Bob was on that day. And he walked into that room and sat down with Bill, and Bill didn't talk to Bob about Bob's drinking. Bill talked to Bob about Bill's drinking. Bill, and that's a very important distinction. And he said, look, dude, this is what I am. This is how I drink. This is how, and I've come up with this idea that if I try to help somebody else out of the hole, I might be able to stay sober. And that was something completely novel to Bob, because Bob had heard all the other stuff before. He heard Ann lecture him, he heard all the preachers lecture him, all that. But now Bill's trying to save his own ass. He wants to help Bob. Bob thought that's pretty cool. And that's why I'm not a huge fan of just giving somebody a big book and say, here, read that. Or actually meeting with them every week and say, reading out of the big book. I'm a fan of telling you exactly what happened in my life and getting you identified with that and getting you to buy into that, if you will. If you're not willing to buy into it, you know, that's on you. But you know what? The most important part about that is I get to stay sober. And that's why I'm here today. And that's why I'm going to start telling you about what it was like for me. And so that's why I think we do this, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, it's not so, and that's the AA. That's Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. It's not all that other stuff. It's all the other stuff springs out of that. But the most important kernel of it is that. So what it was like for me. I grew up in the Midwest. My mother was definitely one of us. To give you kind of an insight into my mom, when she passed away in 2020, I went back to Illinois to help my brothers clean up her place, and we picked up the couch that she basically lived on, and the bottom fell out of it because she had been sitting in that couch and sleeping in that couch, and she had lost all control of her body, and it had just fallen apart from her just peeing on it and just living the alcoholic lifestyle. And that was her. Somewhere along the line, we were at a party, and my sister-in-law came up to me and said, your mom has been drinking a little bit too much, and she's starting to yell at the kids, which was a revelation to me. Because for me and my brothers, that was just her. That's what she did. She yelled at the kids. You know, so that was my life. I grew up with an alcoholic who yelled at the kids. And then when her responsibilities for the day were done, she got her dinner put on the table and we all ate. She sat on the couch and drank beer and then faded away for the night. And that was my life. That's what I grew up in. I will say that, and my dad was basically just not present. And probably because he couldn't stand that. You know, I'm guessing. My life was centered on alcohol, even though I wasn't drinking at the time. And I've come to the, you know, just sort of thought about this as I was, you know, last week or so since John asked me to do this. I was obsessed on alcohol long before I ever took the first drink, because that was life. Life was the drinking stories, and there were always comical drinking stories. They weren't disgusted and sad drinking stories, which, funny enough, when my dad tells the same stories, that's what they are. But when my mom tells the stories, they're comical and funny, and this is, you know, and so it's really a kind of thing. I grew up with the comics, you know, because I heard my mom tell the stories, that she controlled the message. So I was looking forward to a time when I would actually get into the alcoholic lifestyle, not knowing it was alcoholic lifestyle. I just wanted to be a drinker. And so when I finally did take my first drink on April, or it was actually Halloween night, 1982, something happened that night, and it was just a wonderful thing. I don't know, Jack, if you've ever felt this way, awkward, you know, just not feel like I was part of anything. Bill wrote in the 12 and 12, in the fifth step, he says, it's like we were on stage, not knowing the line of our word of our lines, and just being a fish out of water, taking a couple of drinks and let us act extemporaneously, which is a huge word, which means I don't give a fuck, is what it, and so, so that's kind of what happened to me. I went from just being this awkward, alone, just scared man, little boy, really, to becoming, don't care. I'm the most attractive man in the room, obviously. Everybody wants to dance with me. Everybody wants to talk to me. I'm the most interesting man in the world. All of that in the matter of about 3.5 Budweisers. And I went to bed that night, and I decided I would do that as much as I possibly could from that day forward. And forward to the first edition, in the very first sentence of the forward of the first edition, it says, "We are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body," which I think is a really good way, a hopeless state of mind and body, of describing this disease. That night when I went to bed and I turned my will and my life over to the care of alcohol, I was already in a hopeless state of mind. Probably was already there before, because like I said, I was obsessed in alcohol before I even took the drink. But I definitely was obsessed, and I definitely was in a hopeless state of mind that night. And that's when I crossed that line. Later on in the big book, it actually describes the hopeless state of mind as essentially the problem. So I was already in the problem then. And it wasn't that long after that that I was 14, and I did drink as much as I could, which wasn't as much as, you know, wasn't daily, but it was, you know, every week. I remember having an experience where I actually noted in my mind that once I started to drink, I started craving more, and I wanted to drink more and more and more. And I actually, if I couldn't, I got really, really, you know, uncomfortable. You know, I wanted to drink more. So, at that point in time, once that had happened, I was 15, 16 years old. I was already in that state where it talks about in the, it says I was in a hopeless state of mind and body already then. And it really hadn't had any negative consequences at that point in time yet. I will say that I don't know what you guys were thinking about in high school, and you might not be the right sample size and sample group to ask this question. What I was thinking about in high school was, how am I going to get the money first? Who am I going to get to purchase the alcohol for me? Because it was a small town, everybody knew who I was, so I couldn't just walk up to the liquor store and get it. So on and so forth. And I had already made a decision that as a 14-year-old drunk, carrying around a 12-pack in a small town is probably not going to work very well. So I moved into bourbon right away, because they came in smaller, more portable packages. And I was already a logistics master in high school because of my obsession to drink. Because that's what I thought about in class. I was looking out the window thinking about, well, how am I going to get the next, how am I going to set this thing up for the next weekend? So that's where I was. I mentioned that I'm a sloppy, violent, emotionally unstable, just a really, I'm somebody you have to deal with when I get drunk. And that first time that really became, came up was right before I graduated from high school. There was a party at my best friend's house, and we had been drinking all day. And by the time everybody started showing up, I had just gone off the rails. And that's probably, it didn't always happen that way. There was probably two or three times after that that it didn't happen, but that's pretty much my drinking story from that time forward. Every time, just about every time I picked up a drink. That's where the problem started, and how, I don't want to go into this long stretch of drunkalogue other than to let you know that once I took that first drink, I was already mentally in a hopeless state of mind. I had already turned my will, and I was already obsessed on it. I wasn't going to turn away from it. And by the time I was 15, 16 years old, I had already lost physical control of alcohol. But when I start to drink, I can't stop. And I'm convinced that if I picked up one right now, I don't know where it would end up. I'm just as convinced now. But I will just relay this one brief story that I like to talk about, because it really highly emphasizes what it was like for me to drink. I was living in Downey. I was on a ship in Long Beach. I was living in a trailer in Downey. And I came to on a Saturday morning. I'm pretty sure I came to because there was a half pint of, I liked 151. I don't know why you guys drank, but I drank 151 because I believed in what Ozzy Osbourne had to say. Wine is fine, but whiskey's quicker. If you 151, it's even quicker than whiskey. So I drank for oblivion. I drank for anything else. And so I put as much alcohol in me as I possibly could with the smallest amount of efficiency. And so there was a little bit of that left. And so I mixed that up and with some Coke and drank it. And about an hour later, that drink decided it wanted to have a drink. And so I had to walk around the corner. This isn't Downey, the only big town. I could actually go to the liquor store underage there and then buy. And so I did, got a pint of 151, walked back over to the trailer. And about 3 hours later, the pint wanted a drink. And so I walked back around to the same liquor store and got a fifth and drank that. And then my roommate and I decided to go drinking. And we were at this bar around the corner, and we were playing pool, drinking beer, and this guy was there who apparently had some sort of negative interaction with my roommate previously, and so he told me that he had been stealing drinks, beer out of our pitcher all night. And so last call came, and we left, and there he was on the street. And so we decided to take corrective action. And I take corrective action. Downey police called it kidnapping. And I guess the penal code is different than my code. And so I ended up in jail over that. And and I had this, that isn't really the big story. The big part of the story is that, you know, that was a Sunday morning when I ended up in jail. On Monday, I ended up in a cell with these six other guys. And I was starting to come to, and I realized I was in a situation. I'm from the cornfield in the Midwest. And I was in Los Angeles County Jail with some real hardcore people. And I was definitely out of water, and I wasn't drunk anymore. And I was scared shitless. You know what we do when we're scared shitless? You know, we start this transactional relationship we have with a higher power, you know. And that transaction went like, you get me out of this one, and I swear to God, I'll be good. And so 2 days later, he got me out of it. And so I was like, oh, I'm pretty grateful. I walked down the street and had about a buck and a half in my pocket, and that was just enough for the pitcher at the bar I was going to. I completely forgot about that transaction I had made with God 2 days earlier. You know, it was over. I was done. You know, I was out of it. Shakes were done. I was starting to get thirsty again, and so I wanted to drink. And so it wasn't just a few days later, you know, that I was already thirsty again. And I had gone through this whole situation, which was really traumatic for me at the time. And it didn't matter. And so this is, in the big book, it talks about various reasons why we decided we were going to have a drink. You know, life's good, life's bad. But the one it talks about that really hit home for me lately, this is something that's only really kind of been something that I've focused on a little bit over in the last, you know, maybe 10 years, is that despite the knowledge that if I take a drink, really bad things could happen, which I now have a few years of experience knowing that, you know, if I take a drink, and I know that the minute I take a drink, something bad can happen. I know that. And people will get hurt. I just as likely physically hurt somebody when I'm intoxicated. I'm just as likely to disappoint somebody who really cares about me. I called my mom the day I got out of jail, and I bragged to her that I had just gotten out of jail. I had no concern with the impact that that would have on her, you know, despite her being who she was. That hurt her and caused her an amazing amount of worry because she had no control over And I'll get around to why this has an impact on me now. She had no control over that. She couldn't help me. She's back in Illinois. I'm 2,000 miles away in Los Angeles. And she is, and it just, I had no thought of how that would hurt her. And and despite all of that, I'll take the drink anyway. I will make the decision to take a drink without regard for anybody else's concerns, or everybody else's safety, anybody else's health or well-being. And step two, it talks about the insanity of this. And I like to say when I'm talking at meetings, if you're in this seat today because you want to be here, you've already done steps one and two. You may not realize it, and your sponsor may not agree with me. Just refer them to me if you need to. But you've made a healthy decision to come here and be here instead of taking that drink. And that's a sane thought. The insanity is being in that same situation, knowing what the outcome could possibly be, and making the decision to take a drink anyway. You know, this is just insanity in that, you know, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results is insanity. It is, according to Aristotle. But if you look up the definition of what a sociopath is, it's almost exactly the same. Having a complete disregard for the effects your behavior will have on somebody else. It's exactly the same. That's insanity. That's madness. We put people in the loony bin for that. These, you know, people who are serial killers have that same affliction. We really, you know, we as alcoholics, me as an alcoholic, I live that way. You know, the irony is that I didn't stop living that way once I got sober. I still continue to act in ways which I had little regard for other people's lives and what's going to happen in their lives. I just didn't do it with drinking. And so that's kind of where I'm going to end up. But that's where I was. That was kind of, I drank for about another year after that, and it never got better. Never got better. I was starting to get more and more attention from people who were authorities in my life, and they eventually diverted me off to the drug and alcohol program. And I ended up in the Long Beach Hospital on my sobriety date at that time was January 15th of 1989. My actual sobriety date now is April 1st of 1989. So you know what happened when I got out of the hospital. So I took about 3 weeks to do some intensive research over what I had just learned in the hospital, and I was introduced to AA there, and it turns out that, yeah, it's true. You know, once I take a drink, I can't stop, and I don't know what the hell's going to happen. And so I ended up over here at Mare Island on April 1st, and I ended up going into the Vallejo Fellowship on April 3rd, and I've been coming to AA ever since. Now, the cool thing about this, and this is something that I don't want to overlook, I started coming to AA on April 1st of 1989, and I haven't had to have a drink since that day. Something happened in here, despite the fact that I really wasn't coming here on my own, on my own volition or on my own. Something happened here that caused me to not want to drink, you know. And I know what it was, because I'm a people pleaser by a general. And that's part of the growing up in a traumatic household where I was getting yelled at all the time. You know, one of the strategies you come up with going through that is actually trying to be a people pleaser, you know, trying to prevent that yelling from happening. Before you cut it off at the pass, so to speak, rarely worked. But you know, I developed this thing, and I got around here, and I got around to hanging around a few people that actually I kind of wanted to hang out with. You know, Dick remembers this fellow named Jimbo. You remember him too. Jimbo came clean about having smoked dope about a week after I got sober, and he changed his sobriety date. And it was at the men's meeting. And it was the most hilarious meeting I've ever been to, maybe since. I don't know. It was great. And there was something about Jimbo. I just wanted to be around Jimbo. The guy was a goofus, you know, but he was somebody who was actually, I identified with him, you know. And there were some other people around. Maggie was there, and Dick was there, and yeah, and it was just like, just people I just wanted to be around. And I knew that one of the requirements to do that was to not drink, you know. Now, I believe that was God working in my life. You may not agree with it. I absolutely agree with it. There was something attractive about this that was more attractive to me for a little while than the drink was. And so the other thing was that the Navy was making me take Antabuse, and I had drank on Antabuse. You didn't hear that. That sucks. If you ever get put on Antabuse and you want to drink, I'll give you a preview. You get really fucking sick. Yeah. So don't do it. I've done all the research for you. I did it twice just to make sure it was the Antabuse that, I talked about the insanity. What happened, probably the most significant part of those first 90 days was that, I was 20 years old and, I turned 21 and it was an awesome 21. It was a Friday. It was payday. I didn't have duty, and all of my previous birthdays in the Navy, there was always something wrong, and there was something blocking me from going out, but there was probably God working in my life then too, you know. But this one was big, and it was actually, I was going to be able to go out and, you know, drink, but I'm not drinking because, you know, stuck in AA. And so I went out to a bar with this guy I was sharing a barracks room with over there, and I just went in there just to show my card. Hey, you know, I'm 21. And drank a Coke and left. And that triggered a 3 or 4 day period of time where I could not get the thought of a drink out of my mind. It just chased me no matter what. I'd say, oh, yeah, you're not drinking right now. Oh, okay. And then 30 seconds later, I want a drink. And it wouldn't stop. Driving around, white knuckling, grinding my teeth. I wanted a drink so fucking bad. And it was pissing me off that this jackass who drank more than me anyway, who I was sharing that room with, was able to do it. It was really getting on my nerves. And I had this moment of clarity as a result of this. It took about 2 or 3 days, but I finally got there. And the moment of clarity was that people who are normal drinkers do not obsess on the first drink for days at a time. And that's a pretty profound thought. And accompanying that was some sort of a surrender that, you know what? I actually might belong in AA. I actually might be a problem drinker, an alcoholic, as they say. And I actually may have just qualified to be in that room. And that was pretty much right after that, that I actually started coming, because I wanted to be here, and haven't had an obsession like that for the first drink to that degree since that time. I will say that I haven't thought about a drink. That comes up. And this is interesting. It actually came up in a Safeway on Alhambra Avenue in Martinez about 15 years sober. I walked in there. It was Thanksgiving time. And I walked in there to grab a lunch before I was working in Berkeley. I was going to drive over to Berkeley to go to work. And I walked in the door and there was a pyramid of this most deliciously, just lovely displayed bottles of Jack Daniels. And I said, there wasn't 151 Jack Daniels to do it, you know. And so I wanted to drink Jack Daniels so bad. Just it would hit me and I wanted it. I just wanted it. And I walked past it, back to the deli, grabbed a sandwich, grabbed some chips, grabbed a couple of bottles of pop, went up to the counter. And by the time I got to the counter to check out, I was already laughing about it. I was like, that's amazing. I've been sober for a long time, and that still would hit me. And so unlike that time when I went to the show my ID when I was 21, this time it was done in a matter of minutes. And I never came back up again until I started telling that story in AA. You know, because I tell it because this thing isn't cured by any, it's arrested, but it isn't cured. It's going to come up every now and then. And so, so I know for a fact that I'm powerless over this. I'm going to get these thoughts. I'm going to, so on and so forth. It's what I have. If I'm actually living the life I'm living in these rooms, the way I'm supposed to be living it, it has no power over me. I can walk through it and I can walk past it. And it says as much in the big book. I challenge you to go find out where it says that. It's in there. I promise you. The paragraph starts, "We cease fighting everything and everyone." So, covered the insanity. So, I wrote this is another reason why I'm not a huge fan of giving somebody a big book and say, "Hey, go read this." I did. L.A. Jean gave me a big book and said, "Go read this." And so I did. And, there isn't anything in the big books that says when you're done writing your fourth step, go find your sponsor and share it with them. It doesn't say it. It's not in there. It refers to your sponsor in a general way in the 12 and 12, which was written 20 years later. But in the big book, it doesn't say this. Go find somebody you trust. Maybe a priest. It doesn't say anything about sponsors in the big book. So I did. I went and found somebody I trusted, which was another guy who I knew wasn't actually working at that time. I was actually on leave. School was done. I was about ready to move down, go down to San Diego. This guy, I knew he wasn't there. LAG was my sponsor. I knew he was working. I just got this thing done. I want to actually share it with somebody. So I called the guy up. I said, "Hey, can I come over and share this with you?" He goes, "Yeah, come over." And he thought it was weird. I said, "All right, I'm just going to do it." And so I told LAG and picked him up, take him to a meeting that night. He's, "What the fuck are you talking about?" I said, "I did it right out of the big book, exactly the way the big book says. You didn't share it with me?" You know, I ended up having to share it with L.A. Jean a couple weeks later. But if you want to piss somebody off, do the four-step exactly. If you want to piss your sponsor off, do it directly the way it comes right out of the big book, you know. But I do want to talk a little bit about that bit in the big book. For those of you who may not have read it, there is in the chapter How It Works, we read the first part of that chapter at the beginning of most meetings. But right after that, it says, being convinced we are now at step three. And there's two or three pages in there. I'm not going to read them and I'm not even going to quote them, about what we do in order to try to control life around us, you know, to make it okay for us to live within this life. You know, if you do that the way you're supposed to be doing it, and if you act the way you're supposed to be doing it, if everybody's doing it the way they're supposed to do it, and if they just listen to me, we'll all be happy. Well, if you're in control, that means you're playing God, and in no uncertain terms. And it actually says this somewhere. It's buried right in the middle of a paragraph. It isn't even the first sentence in the paragraph. Second sentence in this paragraph, it says, we have to stop playing God. It just doesn't work. And when I think about step three, this is what I'm thinking about. I'm saying I have to stop playing God. I have to stop being the traffic warden on the freeway. I have to be not the guy paying attention to what other people are doing at work. I have to be focused on what I'm doing at work. I have to do all those things. I have to stop doing all that. I just have to stay in my lane and do what I have to do to get through life. And so if I'm playing God, then I'm in trouble. And that's what, in my opinion, that's what the list of resentments is about. And some reason I've determined that whoever's on that list of resentments, I'm deciding that that person needs to have some sort of retribution or they need to be dealt with in some way. And a lot of times, because I came from a background where violence is actually an acceptable solution to problems, I have dealt with these things in a violent way. And that is not going to work for me anymore. And Bill gets a little bit crazy here. He goes, after you write this list of resentments, he says, determining that the rest of the world was wrong is just about as far as most of us ever got. And, which is true. It's the farthest I ever got. And so, And he goes on to say some really cool things in the next few paragraphs. And I cannot overhit this bit, and this is why I've stopped and actually come back and talk about this, because in my opinion, this is where it is in the big book. This is where it is in the steps. This is where the change happens. I flipped my glasses around. I started looking at life in a completely different way, and I started living a happier life because I kind of took in what Bill said there. The one thing, one of the first things he says there is that we've come to the conclusion that when I'm thinking that the world is wrong, I've allowed the world to dominate me. I've given up my agency as any kind of an effective member of society, because now I'm reacting to the way the world treats me. And if I'm in reacting to the way the world treats me, then I'm not able to do any kind of good in this world. And so that's the first thing I have to stop, is I have to stop reacting to the way the world treats me. And he did this really famous paragraph that everybody quotes. And it says, anger is the dubious luxury of the normal man. It actually goes on. He says, it's not quite anger, but he actually says, the grouch and the brainstorm are the dubious luxury of normal men. Now, I had a long time to really figure out what a brainstorm was, you know. And I finally come to the conclusion that, and I'm sure I won't be the only one in this room who's ever done this. Have you ever been driving down the road, maybe on your way home from work, and you're thinking about something that that son of a gun said at work, and maybe you're gripping that steering wheel a little bit tighter, grinding your teeth, and maybe you're thinking about what you should have said in that situation. I should have told, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what Bill's talking about with the brainstorm. That's, in my opinion, that's what a brainstorm is. And if I'm in that, again, I'm not doing what I need to be doing in life. Then he follows that up. We had to stop doing this. How do we do this? How do we get out of that? And this is it, Maggie. I've been here 36 years waiting to say this to you. And I'm not going to say it the way Bill said it. I'm going to say it the way it works for me. The way it works for me is that if I can accept that everybody on the planet is doing the absolute best they possibly can be doing, and give them their permission to do that, then I'm going to be a hell of a lot more happy. You know, I may not like what happens when they do the best they possibly can do. It might cause me some discomfort. But if I'm thinking that they're doing the best they possibly know how to do, then they're not a son of a bitch, and I don't have to correct their behavior, and I get to go home happy, sober, without handcuffs on. And I've gone through some things in my sobriety where, you know, there's amends that I make because of behaviors I've done in sobriety. If I'm on a BART platform and it's busy, I have to wait for everybody else to get on that train before I get on. And that's because if I get in that crowd, I'm going to be throwing elbows, and I'm going to be an asshole, and somebody's going to get hurt. I can't do that. I can't do that and live life as a happy person. So I have to let everybody else get on that train. And if I miss the train because I waited too long, then I'm going to have to wait for the next one, because I'm not mature enough to behave like a human being in that pack. And so I have to get out of that way. When I'm at Costco, I park at the back of the parking lot and walk in. Why? Because I'm not mature enough to sit in and wait for a parking spot to open. I'm going to act like an asshole. I just know it. So this is my amends to the world because of the way I've behaved in the past. I go to the back of the parking lot. And it's just, that's what I do, because this is how I'm implementing what I'm talking about in my life. So I've got about 10 more minutes. Is that okay with everybody? Okay. This is, I suspect this is why Gordon told John to ask me to talk. And so this is why we're going to go here. So my that I've gotten you to where I was about 6 months sober. I ended up down in San Diego. I was on a cruiser. We ended up heading over to the Desert Storm, and I was in the Persian Gulf right after Desert Storm. I'm considered a war veteran, even though it was all done by the time I got there. And I was not able to do my job the way it was supposed to be done because I did not know how to do it. And it wasn't my primary job. It was the collateral duty I had. And I was lying about having done it because I didn't want to. I was too prideful to ask anybody for help is what it really come down to. And that got me to a bottom. And I had to start writing another four-step when I was out in the middle of the Persian Gulf. And I whipped out a 12-12, and I went through the 12-12 and wrote a pretty thorough four-step out of that 12-12. And my sponsor at the time, now I know I'm supposed to talk to the sponsor, was in San Diego. And so I was I got back to San Diego. He was a night watchman at this laboratory up in La Jolla. And so I drove up when he was on watch one night, and I shared this four-step with him. And that was a pretty freeing moment. And there are things I did in my life in sobriety prior to that I would not do again. And first of all, when I came around to getting married again, when I stood up in front of all, Joe was there. Joe and Liz were there. I stood up in front of everybody and I said, as long as love shall last, but what I meant, until death do us part. And I meant it. And I meant it. And if she had also meant it, I would still be in that marriage. And I'm proud of that. We had a child. And the reason why I want to bring up that child is because I've learned more about God through him than I have from any other source in life. And this is where I'm going to go. So most of you know that that's not a happy ending. You know, in 2011, she decided it was done. So we split up. And also in 2020, along with my mother passing away, Stand Up Mike, my sponsor, passed away that summer, and the girl I was dating a very serious relationship with, she also passed away that, you know, within a couple of months of each other. It was a really rough year. And Maggie, I'd do it over and over again 10 times before I did whatever I did in 2016. And that was when my son was arrested. And he committed a homicide. And it was capital homicide. He had to plea bargain to life without parole so that he did not go to death row. My ex-wife and I talked on the phone one night, and she said that if he'd have died in a car crash, it would have been easier than this. And I absolutely agree with her. Some people will say some things to you that are very, very truthful, and they will identify. And that was one of the most truthful things that woman ever said to me. And I agree with her. It would have been easier if he had died in a car crash. If you're a parent, which a lot of you are, we live through what the future is through our children. We look forward to being grandparents. We look forward to growing old and being part of that, and that just is cut off right then and there, done. And it was an awful, awful thing to go through. And I want to tell you a couple of things that happened as a result of that. One was the fellowship. I was the secretary of St. Paul's meeting on Sunday night, and I sat down in front of everybody, and I couldn't get through the format. I couldn't even get through the moment of silence and doing the Serenity Prayer. Margaret Buckley was a really good friend of mine. She actually just jumped up there and took over the meeting that night. The previous night, it was a Doyle Drive meeting. It used to be a Saturday night meeting in Vallejo. I sat in the back, and there was Margaret, Josh Glaze, a couple other people, just a wall around me. Because if you'd have come up and asked me, hi, if you said hi to me, I would have fell apart. Couldn't have done it. Couldn't have done anything. Now, if you know somebody that's going through something like that, or you know somebody who just lost somebody close to them or whatever, you can call them. And the most honest thing you might be able to say, it would be the best thing to say, is, I don't know what to say to you right now. I just want to let you know you're on my mind. And it doesn't have to be anymore. And that's, I turned my phone, I cut off Facebook, I did everything. But one guy got his call in, and he said that to me. And it was the most beautiful thing. It's, you know, there's one of us, one of an AA, a good friend of mine in AA. And I'll never forget it. And he's not here. If he was here, he would be giving me the finger right now, because he's sure shit wouldn't want me pointing it out to him. Yeah. So, but that was a beautiful thing. And so I was immediately surrounded by AA. And it was cool. It was really cool. And another thing that happened, and this is where I'm going to go. I was in the room when that boy was born. He was a C-section. The first sight I had of him was his head having emerged from his mother, but the rest of him was still inside. I've known him since he was that many years old. And other than the nurses who were cleaning him up and getting him breathing, I was the first person to hold him. I carried him to his mother after she got out of the surgery. I was in that boy's life. There wasn't ever a time in that boy's life he did not know where I was and how available I was for him at any time. I taught him to throw a baseball. I taught him how to hit a baseball. I taught him how to drive. You're supposed to have other people actually who are licensed to teach you how to drive in California. He already knew. I taught him. I did all that stuff with him. I went to work every day. I brought my paychecks home. Everything was available for him. That's how much involved in that boy's life I was. And if you're involved in somebody's life like that, you absolutely, without any reservation, love that person. And I absolutely, without reservation, love my son. Outside of the people who know me and know us, Solano County in general does not have a high opinion of my son. I've made the mistake of getting on the newspaper website the day he was sentenced and read some of the comments in the story, and they were not nice. They were really, really not nice. I reflected on that, and I said that it's an interesting thing that I could not have that opinion of him because he's my son. But other people do have that opinion of him. And I'm not going to say they're not justified in that opinion, because what he did was pretty fucked up. But he's my son. And so I'm in this bubble. I don't, you know, I've shared this with people before. And I'll always feel that way about him. Always will. We talk usually about once a week on the phone. I go to visit him every 3 or 4 months over in Ion. And we've had some really powerful talks. He's gone through problems while he's been out there. He's been on heroin a lot. He says he's not now. I don't know. You know, I'm open-minded enough to know that me as a parent, I might not have the most objective point of view on that. And so it's a difficult thing. But I will not ever stop loving him. So think about that for a second. And think about all the horrible things you might have done on your journey to get here. You know, all the people you screwed over, all the bad things you've done, all the self-talk you've done to yourself. We're our worst critics. We're absolutely worse. All the times you felt so low that, you know, This is one of my favorites. I hear it all the time. And I felt like this in AA too, when I was first here. These people have to like me, but once they really get to know me, you know, they're not going to like me no more, you know? And that hasn't happened yet. Either you haven't gotten to know me yet, or you still like me anyway. But God feels about you exactly the way I feel about my son. Let that sit with you for a minute, you know, because he's the father, and you're the child. And in his eyes, despite of all the stuff you've said to yourself, all the things you've actually done and all the things you do, that doesn't matter. The slate's clean as far as he's concerned. You know, it's the same way that my son's slate is clean with me. And I feel the same way about with God about me and about you, all of us in this room. But the slates are all clean. They were already clean before you even did your fourth and fifth step. That's actually part of the reason why you do it, is to actually figure out, hey, you're already clean, you know. And we love you no matter what, you know. We don't care, you know. If you ever hear a story in here, people talking about, you know, a DUI, comical DUI story, or, you know, failing the field sobriety test so bad, or got a divorce. There was one guy came and he lost his job and got a divorce all in the same week. And his sponsor laughed at him. He said, hey, you got all the shit out of the way, you know. And we laugh at that stuff. The rest of the world doesn't laugh, doesn't think it's very fucking funny at all. But we do, because that's you know, we know now you're one of us. You get to be sit in this chair. You get to sit in the, you're going to look each one of us in the eye. I get to look every one of you in the eye. And I know that that's what it's all about. And that's recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And if I could be there, and it's my hope and what I like to do, or what my ambition is to make this a comfortable, welcoming place for everybody when they walk in here, so they actually do feel accepted the way it was done when I got here. And that's what I'd hope to give away, and that's hope, you know, all I hope to communicate today. And I'm done talking, Jack.
Jack said stop talking when you're done talking, so there you go.